open it up for questions. Anybody has any questions? You have a question?
What's your question?
Already, okay. Well, you gradually look after your memory and you'll be able to remember.
One thing that comes just thought that I have, yeah. Like that image of like planting a seed.
Yeah.
And planting a seed, watering it, letting it grow, and ripens into the fruit according to the seed. Yep. So if you think about it, in terms of our Dhamma practice, the seed that we plant, it's got to be a seed that comes from the Buddha, in that sense, because, and that's where, like, it's not just meeting anybody and hearing their teachings and then practicing accordingly. It's got to actually be meeting somebody who's representing the Buddha's teachings accurately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, I mean, that's for, obviously, that's a, you know, a causal condition that is really helpful. In that one, yeah, I mean, you reap the fruits of what is planted. Mm-hmm. And the seeds of particular view, you know. I think I mean, you were just at a Christian Buddhist monastic dialogue, and there's a very different seed planted that is ripening in a different kind of a fruit.
Yeah,
So that it's important to recognize, one, in a sense, clarifying. Well, what kind of fruit do I actually want? And if that's the kind of fruit I want, then what kind of seed do I want to be looking after?
Right.
Yeah.
I have a question. Yeah. The example you gave with the snake.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear any story or example of that, because, like, obviously the snake analogy, that's kind of obvious, like a snake that would be poisonous and bite you, so the idea of picking it up incorrectly, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
But the idea of picking up the Dhamma and having the Dhamma bite you,
oh sure,
that's a little harder. Like, could you give some example of how the Dhamma could bite you, or even some anecdote?
Oh, tons.
You
okay? Yeah, good example right off the top of my head. What pops into my head? One of the very popular monasteries in Thailand right now is a outskirts of Bangkok, Dhammakaya monastery. They take the teachings and then they interpret the teachings in terms it's for kind of. It's all about, say, Dhammakaya is your true self. Sort of like that is your true self. This is absolutely permanent and completely blissful. So that is the and the way to reach it is through making as much monetary offerings as you can to their group. And then you can get to all the different levels of Nibbana, which are defined by the different, you know, how much money you give is actually what you end up getting in these realms of enlightenment. Very wrong grasp of the teaching. It's very popular. Because it's a lot easier than keeping precepts and practicing meditation. So that's a good example of that. There's There's a very common occurrence in some Dhamma circles of studying Abhidhamma, which is a they're sort of kind of metaphysical teachings and psychological maps of the of the teachings, and the probably the most kind of bitter and vociferous arguments in Dhamma come from sort of Abhidhamma students. Very intense. And that's very common. I remember Ajahn Chah, there was this well-known Abhidhamma teacher came to Wat Bapong. And she was brought there by somebody else because they respect Ajahn Chah, and that particular teacher didn't really have much faith in any of the forest teachers. And then Ajahn Chah, he was kind of asked about some kind of exposition of the teachings, and Ajahn Chah just sort of said, well, Abhidhamma says 1 + 1 = 2. I just say 2. In the sense, there's all these details that go into it, and in reality, there's this truth. And he didn't open it up for argument and contention, because that happens all the time. So those are two that come just off the top of my head. And then there's any number of arguments and quarrels that end up in different. Arguing over different meditation techniques. Which one's the best meditation technique? Which one's the right meditation technique? Clinging to that particular, some sort of method. So that happens all the time. So yeah, those are examples.
Yeah. Like the way I've always interpreted that passage is like, if you think about the Buddha's teachings as being a method to purify the, for lack of a better word, purify the heart, to kind of mm-hmm. be free yourself from greed, hatred, and delusion.
Yep.
Well, you've got to have that as your intention. So the bottom line, the reason you're studying suttas is to purify your heart. At the end of the day, anybody who's going to purify their heart has to have that intention. And I'll tell you, because I think there's a few Dhamma teachers in this room, and if you ever are studying the suttas for the sake of teaching, okay, it's okay. It's still, you've got to study your stuff and know what you're teaching, so that's certainly true. But the bottom line is the reason you're coming across the teachings in the first place is because you've got to have the intention to purify your own heart. And even if you don't have that intention, the way it kind of bites you and kind of bites you in the back is because you're just not going to get the fruits. Like, you actually might spread Dhamma on one level, but basically you're not the cause that's going to actually put an end to greed, hatred, and delusion in your own heart isn't being put in place, isn't being planted. So that's another.
Yes, John.
Speaking on that question and answer, what are some good ways of looking into one's heart and asking some questions? I mean, one just obvious one is just ask ourselves that question when we're alone, but are there other, in a broader sense, like, how does one look at intention?
Well, sometimes you don't want to look at intention too closely because you'll convince yourself of anything. what you have to do is look at results in the sense that that's where the Four Noble Truths are really helpful in that sense of there's an experience of, you know, kind of dissonance, discontent, dis-ease, there's some kind of dis-ease there. So then that's the indication that we need. Then we start tracking, hey, what's going on here? What have I missed? Whereas, looking to, what's my intention? One, end up psychologizing it a bit too much. Or, yeah, we can easily, it's the nature of delusion to keep deluding ourselves.
You overlook the intention that wants to look at your intention.
Yeah.
You don't recognize it. Your intention in trying to investigate your intention is to not realize your true intention.
And then, yeah, Rick.
You said, what's the intent of your intention? And so I have a question. So when we talk about, you say it's like some of these others, that awakening, that all of a sudden, awaken, understand it, and it's the gradual. Part of my question might be, there's the times where we have like aha moments, and it's like, aha, it feels like, wow, I've awakened to really understand something, really makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I feel like, maybe I'm awakened to something here, but then it also puts me more into practice and maybe looking at what it is, and the next thing I know, I probably forgot what that even was.
Yeah.
I'm back into the loops.
Yeah.
I think they keep bringing me in those aha moments, bring me back into the loop again to go to another level.
Yeah.
Something, you know, there's like, okay, practicing, it's going, it's,
And that's where those aspects, so, you know, and when the Buddha's talking, is coming to them, so the aspects of faith and confidence, or kind of desire and zeal, or effort, and then those all sort of, they keep feeding the process, and that nurturing and supporting process of development.
So my question goes, like, sometimes when I read something, somebody said they were awakened, and I'm just wondering, is that, it's like, they're awakened, like, really understand something now, and they really, you know, put some more into practice, that they're in it, could it have been, it's like, they weren't touching as part of the Dhamma, now they're really awakened to these teachings, it came to another level. And I've always wondered, that could also have been what it meant. It's like, I understand what that person's teaching is, because then they always still continue to practice.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, in the sense of, you know, people, you know, we throw language around in many different ways, and it's hard to tell sometimes. Because you know, oftentimes the language that is used is oftentimes used to inspire, you can only tell what somebody else's experience is by, I don't know.
You can't.
You can't. Yeah, you can't really. And that's where that's why it's so important to be able to feed that. A hearing of a teaching back into one's own process, just like the Buddha was saying, that one, you know, the faith or the acceptance that we had of a particular person or a particular teaching, it may be true, and it may end up being just hollow and false. The only, in the end, it's so important for us to be able to keep bringing it back to this sifting, investigating, and verifying. Danny.
Well, I was just thinking about that, with the simile of the snake, it's like it seems certainly true for my practice, it's been the process of learning learning how to pick up a poisonous snake involves getting bitten quite a lot. So that's sort of like...
Well, that's why, yeah, like suffering is, you know, it's really, it's so much the teacher. That's where you really have to be willing to be kind of humble enough to make mistakes, to flounder around sometimes and start over. That's where we really learn. Yes.
In the West, you know, there are so many religions come from East, especially Hinduism. I mean, there's not only one tradition. I don't know much, but there are different rishis and maharishis and saints, and there's Buddhism. And sometimes we use same words to mean different things.
Yes.
And among Westerners, there are confusion.
Yeah.
And what is best, like what Buddha does, why that Nirvana would be the best way. There are other rishis and maharishis and all these things. I mean, I'm not confused.
Well, really? Good for you.
I
Yeah.
And I feel very sad. I don't have a question, but I would like to ask, like, how do you convince them? Like, my interpretation is that, even though I believe that, I'm not going to say Buddha's path is the best way.
There's no need to... Yeah, you don't need to... The Buddha himself didn't try to actually convince anybody. He taught people who came to him to receive teachings. Obviously at some points when he was... especially the discourse that I read of the... That where he's being pressed in debate or being challenged, and the Buddha just sort of lays it out in very clear kind of ways of causal conditions and factors, and these are the results, and these are the different ways that we hold belief, but in the end the Buddha, his mission wasn't really to convince anybody of anything. He was willing to teach if people showed an interest. But if people don't have an interest, then it's best to focus on one's own practice. even me here. I've been an abbot for 30 years and. I'm quite happy. One of the reasons I'm happy is because I don't feel I have to go and convince anybody anything. If people want to come here, okay. I mean, it's more work for me if people come here. But but I'm not looking for anybody to come. Yeah. You know, so I think that's an important aspect of clarifying the teachings for oneself, and then if people show an interest, then the more clear one is oneself, then the more one is able to actually help others. But if there isn't an interest, it's very difficult. Yes?
I had a comment. When you were talking about faith comes from building the confidence.
Yeah.
And confidence comes from your experience.
Yeah.
And that is so true. I was thinking about it, thinking, if we, more people could practice that and experience more and to build their confidence, to build their faith.
Mm. Yeah.
There are so many conflicts between people, between cultures that probably go away.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Actually, that's a good note to end this bit of the session with. Let's have a bit of a break. Come back in 15 minutes.